And welcome back to the Sabbatarianism Podcast. My name is Justin Hoos. I am the host. This is going to be episode 42, and I have with me, not back with me, but with me, a new guy, a fill-in, Mr. Neil. Do we want to use your last name, Neil? You all right with that?
It don't matter.
Okay. Mr. Neil Saul. Richard is out this week and last. Probably next week. His wife had a pretty serious surgery, and he is with her as she convalesces and heals up, and we all have been praying for him and hope that everything with that surgery works out well. But anyway, Neil is a brother here at our local Texarkana congregation, and he's a longtime member. I've known him for, oh gosh, probably going on 10 years now. We met at the feast. And Neil, say hello to the people.
Hello.
Neil is going to fill in while Richard's gone, and maybe I can talk him into coming back even after that. Richard and I have been trying to talk him into coming over and working with us a little bit. And as yet, this is he is not accepted. So anyway, Neil, in the very beginning, Richard and I kind of introduced ourselves and our background and how we came to Sabbatarianism. So if you don't mind, why don't you go ahead and start there and kind of tell the people a little bit about yourself.
All right. I grew up in a Quaker church in northeast Iowa.
Okay.
It was interesting that my mother was the one that took us. I don't remember my father ever coming to church.
Okay.
But
to the Quaker church.
Yeah.
Okay.
But he, subsequently has, but not back then. I have to admit, they taught me a lot. It was very influential in my life up until I got my driver's license.
Okay.
And then I started working, and I was going after money. And I go off to college, and I started searching. And I kept searching, and I knew there was something missing. Get out of
spiritually.
Yeah, spiritually. There was a hole in my heart that I was trying to fill. So I continued looking, but in all the wrong places. I still going after the money. And then in 1982, I had a crisis in my life.
Okay.
And I prayed and prayed, and I was on my knees in front of my bedroom window, looking out. It was raining, and I'm like, Lord, just, convince me, because literally I was suicidal. And it was raining. There was a street light across the road, and here's this circle around the street light because of the screen, and there was a cross in it.
Okay.
And interestingly, at the time, previously, not long before that, I had read a book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And it wasn't about the god Zen, which is Buddhist.
I think it's Buddhist. So. It's a term from Buddhism.
Yeah,
is it a god figure?
Well, I'm not sure what it is,
okay,
actually. Because the book is really about this man and his son that were kind of estranged. Take a 3,000-mile motorcycle trip, and how their relationship changed, and they bonded really tight.
Okay.
So one day I have four vehicles, company vehicles to drive, and the next day I don't have any vehicle at all. So I buy a motorcycle, and I went on a 2,000-mile trip, and everything he said in that book was true. He said, you driving, this was back before, nowadays they got radios and everything else on a motorcycle, but
back then it was just you and
the buzz,
a motor and a seat.
Yeah, and I ended up going back through my hometown, and I got my Bible, and I got back to Texas and started reading it, and I'll never forget. It's like I didn't get through the first chapter of Genesis when it says, "Let us make man in our image." Who are you talking to?
Yep.
And just things started popping into my head, and kept studying, and lo and behold, at that time I was golfing every Saturday and Sunday morning, and I got to the story of Abraham, how he kept God's commandments, his charges, statutes, and I'm like, well, what are those? And I searched them out.
This is long before Mount Sinai.
Yes, yes. You know, and that never entered my mind. But I got to the Ten Commandments, and it's like, okay, I could see where the Sabbath was created on the seventh day, and God said, keep the Sabbath. So I had to tell my golfing buddies that I wasn't going to be there on Saturday mornings anymore. And I spent all day Saturday studying. And I'm
by yourself?
Yeah, pretty much just by myself.
Okay.
And I found out one morning, one Sunday morning, I was getting ready to leave, and here comes, I had the TV on, just noise in the background, and Herbert Armstrong was on, telling people that the Sabbath has not been done away with. And
just happened to be on the radio, and you...
It was on TV, but...
Oh, TV, excuse me.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I thought, well, that's interesting, but it was like, I had to be at the golf course at 6 o'clock, and the show went till 6 o'clock, so I had to leave a little early. And as winter came, I could stay longer because the sun didn't come up quite so early, and I just watched those programs. But I actually started attending Worldwide Church of God until about 1986 or 87, and something had changed after the death of Herbert Armstrong, I felt. And I didn't feel comfortable being there. So I kept looking for a church. And I didn't know there was any others out there. As a matter of fact, I was told there wasn't. And lo and behold, I stumble across Garner Ted Armstrong, and I go attend one of his campaigns, I guess he called it, and met with the local congregation after that. And
this is near Dallas, right?
This is in Dallas.
Okay.
And they were the best people I ever met. They were so friendly. So for 4 or 5 years in the Worldwide Church of God, I didn't hardly meet anybody. Nobody ever came up to me and shook my hand or anything. You know, you had 500 to 1,000
people.
Yeah,
big.
Yeah. And, you know, they had compared to most congregations today, we had 100 people or over 100 people in the congregation.
With Garner Ted.
Yeah, in Dallas, but on average Sabbath there was probably only 80 or so that were there. But they were still became very close friends. Everybody there, I just knew I was home. I was in the right place. Well, time would go on, and I became a renegade. And ironically, the church, you know, split up and became originally two congregations, and then it was six congregations, and then it was like time to leave Dallas, and I moved out to East Texas here, Northeast Texas, and ended up here in Texarkana. It's been almost 20 years now, I guess, or maybe a little more, 21 years I've been attending this congregation, and just kind of, you know, it's always been my position, I guess, in the church is anybody that needs help, I want to be there to help.
Yeah.
So that's you know, I wanted to be a servant and please God. And so I found a home here. But none of us think we're, you know, a pillar in this church.
Yeah.
We're just servants to the people that come here. It's a lot easier to be a servant to 10 or 15 people than, you know, 100.
500.
Yeah, a whole bunch. But Richard has just taught me so much, I've known him long. I forget. He and Nancy, how long they've been married, I forget. They just had an anniversary.
I think it's going on 17.
17? Well, I knew him before Nancy, so.
Okay.
So it's been a while.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's basically my story.
Yeah.
And how I got here.
All right. So let's see. Let's go on and announce here what we're going to do. So in our weekly Bible study that you're at and I'm at and Richard and Mary and everyone else, my mom, we are back in Genesis. We've started over. You guys, before I got here, read through the entire Bible as a congregation. Hats off. Kudos. That's an incredible accomplishment. and not one that I've ever heard of any other congregation doing. So kudos to you guys. Go ahead.
Well, we went through the New Testament twice.
Yeah. And Richard's papers. But I think it took you guys, 4.5 years to?
It was 3.5 the first time.
To go through the whole Bible.
Yeah.
Okay. So we started over, and we're back in Genesis, and we were reading through this past week, and we got up to Genesis 39, and one of the
37.
Okay, my mistake. we got up to 39, though, didn't we?
Oh, awesome! I think we got farther than that.
Yeah, we might have. As we were doing that, both you and a guy that attends with us named Zach were pointing out all the similarities between Joseph and the Messiah. And it's something that I've been really interested in. This past feast, a couple people that I attended with were talking about all the similarities and had kind of done a study on it. And I said, well, how about we do a Bible or a podcast on that? And, you know, due to circumstances and all that goes on at the feast, we never did get to it. But I've been wanting to do a study on this. So since Richard was out with Nancy and helping her as she convalesces, I asked Brother Neil if he wanted to come in and talk about the parallels between Joseph and Jesus. And it just so happened that Neil had a study in his Bible that's been there, 10 years?
No, it's been 30 almost. it wasn't long after I first got on the internet, which was early 90s. So.
Okay.
Yeah, it'd been around a long time, and it's always been in there for whatever
reason.
Just been
a paper in your Bible.
Nothing that ever got thrown away anyway.
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to go through this. And kind of step by step it. The paper is called "How Does the Life of Joseph Foreshadow Jesus?" And it's from The Gleanings in Genesis by A.W. Pink. Apparently, this guy Pink is from like early 1900s, late 1800s. This is from a while ago. And it was put out by Baptist Church, but I found it in several other places. So I feel comfortable sharing it on my site.
Sure.
So look around on the Sabbatarianism podcast, and you should be able to find a copy of this paper. And you can read through it with us or share with friends or whatever you want to do there. But we're just going to start going through this and kind of read the scripture that is associated with it and then maybe talk it over between ourselves. So we first start off in Genesis 37. And verse 2, this is basically just the start of what it calls, "Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob." And in our Bible study this past weekend, we kind of thought, is this an inset chapter here? Just because of that statement right there. It's like the story's going along, and then this is the history of Jacob, and we all kind of talked. What do you think? Do you think it's kind of an inset here?
I don't know what it is. to me, it's a story of Joseph, and I wonder if somebody didn't make a mistake. put the wrong name in there.
Okay. Yeah, because the very next word here is, "Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father." Now that does go to the first two here on this list, where it says that Joseph was a shepherd, which we read that, and Joseph was opposed to and exposed evil. Me personally, that works. I mean, he's just talking about his brothers here, and we don't know what they've done. So, I don't know, exposing evil, that's maybe a bit of a stretch, but I can see where the guy's going with that. So, anyway, it goes on to say in the first part, Jesus is the great shepherd, and points to John 10.
And it's verse 14, and this is Jesus talking, that says, "I am the good shepherd, and I know my own, and my own know me."
Yeah.
So.
And that's from a psalm? Is it a psalm or?
Is it a psalm or is it?
One of the.
Isaiah, maybe. I forget.
Yeah, it might be. He's referencing something there.
Yeah.
The whole Good Shepherd thing. So Joseph was opposed to and exposed evil. And then it says Jesus did the same. No quotes, but that's a pretty easy one. I mean,
I would say the whole life of Christ
was exposing evil.
Yeah.
And not only the evil in the spirit world with his confrontation with the devil and the temptation, as well as casting out demons, but he exposed the evil that was in that was being taught by the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And
I would say, you know, for sure, at least in Judea at that time, he exposed the evil of the corrupt leaders.
Yeah.
And which he could do today real easy too.
No doubt. All right, so the third one here is Joseph was loved by his father, and it's referencing Genesis 37, 3 and 4. So Genesis 3, now Israel, or Jacob, loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him.
And the quote for Jesus was beloved by his father, we know that's true, but Matthew 3:17, and behold, a voice out of the heavens saying, let me go back to 16. And after being baptized, Jesus went up immediately from the water, and behold, the heavens were opened, and he, that would be John, saw the Spirit of God descending as a dove, and coming upon him, Jesus. And behold, a voice out of heaven saying, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. There's several others. I don't know that we need to go to all of them, but there is one another, that same saying at the Transfiguration.
Right.
And interesting, is that 17:5?
Yeah.
Let's go there and look at that one.
Well, I pulled up one of them here, and it's just John 10, and it's actually Jesus speaking himself. And it says, therefore, my Father loves me because I lay down my life that I may take it again.
Yeah. There's
a lot on this one.
Yeah.
That's a pretty easy one.
Matthew 17:5, at the time of the Transfiguration,
okay.
while he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of heaven saying, same quote, and I like this really well, this is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him.
Right.
And I think that's so important that, you know, that was to me for the benefit of, that was what, John, Peter, and who's the other one there?
I think it was John.
James.
Okay.
Yeah, so in verse 1 it says James.
Yeah.
That was for their benefit. But it's for ours too.
Yeah.
You know, if and that's why I like the Red Letter Bible, because I've gone through all the Gospels and just read the red letters. You know, that's Jesus talking. All the other stuff, you know, is commentary and what have you. But just read what he has to say.
Yeah, as far as that goes, I think listen to him, it could also be follow him.
Yeah.
Follow what he does. Follow where he goes.
Do what he does.
Follow him wherever he goes.
That's right.
I would also add to this, and I know you've read the prophecy of the barren wife as well, is that Joseph was the son of the loved wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The first son.
Right.
So he was the eldest or the firstborn of the loved wife.
Yeah.
And
not of the wife of obligation.
Right, right. Which is who he was out in the field with and gave a bad report about, was the sons of the wives of legal obligation.
Yes.
All right. Number 5. And by the way, this list goes to 60.
I think one podcast ain't going to do it.
Yeah, probably not. Because it is an exhaustive study. This guy's trying to find it all. So good for him. Joseph was hated for his words, and it's calling out 37:4.
Well, and you'd already read that.
Yep, I did.
Yeah.
Hated by his brothers.
Yeah.
That was number 5 that I read off there. I goofed. So yeah, number four is actually Joseph was hated by his brothers. And yeah, that's pretty clear there. So for Jesus, it says Jesus was hated by his brothers, and it's called out John 1:11 and Luke 19:14.
And John 1:11 says that he being Jesus, came into his own, to his own people, and those who were his own did not receive him, especially in his hometown. But
a prophet can't be a prophet in his hometown.
Right. But that also applies to all of Judea.
Yeah. I think that's what this guy's saying here, is he's really referencing the Jews in general. The people of the tribe of Judah hated him, not necessarily his brothers by blood.
That's probably true after his resurrection, maybe not before.
So we talked about this in the Bible study, and I don't know. It's my understanding that two of his brothers were disciples.
But, you know, originally they weren't. They even mocked him because first he wasn't going to go to, I don't remember if it was Passover or Tabernacles, but they mocked him because he wasn't going to go. And then he ended up going in secret.
Yeah.
And I don't think they didn't believe that he was who.
Yeah, but that's a far cry from hated.
Well, yeah.
I mean, it's different than the way Joseph's brothers loathed him.
Well, I agree.
But anyway.
And then the other verse quoted there is, what, Luke 19:14.
Yeah.
Okay, now this is actually part of the parable of, I don't know what the parable's called. The parable of the talents or the miners is what my version says.
Okay.
But it says, but his citizens, and he is the king that went on a journey and is coming back. I think that's how it's, so I'll go back to 12. A certain nobleman went to a distant country to receive a kingdom for himself and then return. So that's Christ. And in verse 14, but his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. And actually, there's another quote I'd found earlier that, and I didn't write it down, but the Jews said the same thing.
Yeah.
During his trial, I believe. So definitely, it may not apply to everybody that hated him like Joseph's brothers did, and it may not apply to...
Well, I think the Pharisees and all them hated him.
Yes, yes.
In the same way that Joseph hated by his brothers, because it was envy.
But
it was envy-driven.
Well, we'll get to that in a little while.
Yeah.
His brethren being the...
People of the tribe.
Yeah. In this case, Jews, for the most part, until a certain period, they pretty much hated him, except for those that were being called,
yeah.
which is kind of true today.
Yeah, no doubt. Okay, so let's go on to number five here, the one I accidentally jumped ahead and read just before, is Joseph was hated for his words, and it calls out 37:8 on that, Genesis 37:8. And his brothers said to him, quote, shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now, this is a really interesting one that you brought up this past Sabbath, I think. Yeah. Where this is the prophecy about the sheaves that bowed down before the big sheaf, right? This is one of Joseph's dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is specific to his brothers, whereas the other dream includes both his mother, father, and his brothers, and that this particular one that only deals with his brothers was fulfilled when they came to Egypt and they all bowed down before him. I thought that was a really good one. So anyway, the parallel for this is Jesus was hated for his words. That's I don't know, the whole New Testament. but they call out John 7 and verse 7 and also John 3 and verse 32.
And John 7:7 says, the world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it, that its deeds are evil. That gets back to number 2, I think. And then the other one was John 3:32.
Yeah.
Which says, what he has seen and heard, of that he bears witness, and no man receives his witness.
Hmm. Okay.
And then 33 goes on and says, he who has received his witness has set his seal to this, that God is true.
Okay. So both of them hated for their words. That's a check. So number six. Joseph was promised a remarkable future. And we're going to go to Genesis 37, verse 7 through 12. In verse 7, there we were, binding sheaves. So it's again him going through this dream. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. And his brothers said to him, here it is again, shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowed down to me. So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. And Richard's referenced that before in some of our talks. But here, I think what this guy is saying is Joseph gets promised a big future when... in reference to these two times. And again, you pointed out how the sheaves is really fulfilled when he had an incredible future with, you know, running Egypt and all of that. But this, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars, that still points to yet something out in our future.
Well, and the in that dream, his mother was dead.
Right.
So it couldn't apply to her unless it was a future time. Which is still
and
yet
and that's
future.
Why his father kept it in mind. That's Richard's position on it. Yeah,
I agree. I think, too, that it was like, you know, he didn't want to accept it, but it's like, well, evidently, I mean...
this is providential because mom's dead and...
Well, here's the thing is Jacob had dreams, too. God exposed knowledge to him through dreams, so he knew that was possible. And so he had to take that into consideration.
And being that it was Joseph, was probably more powerful to Jacob as well. All right, so the parallel to that is, that was Joseph was promised a remarkable future. Jesus looked past the cross to the joy set before him. If the parallel would be Jesus promised a remarkable future, I think that's a pretty easy one.
I think that already happened, I think.
Well, and more to come.
More to come. So the quote is from Isaiah 9, is it?
Yeah.
Verse 6, for a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace.
That's one of my favorite verses in the whole Bible.
And that, you know, those those titles will be, he'll be supreme to all others, even at the end of the age.
Yeah.
So that's a future.
And then it calls out Luke 1, verse 31 through 33.
And behold, you will receive in your womb and bear a son, or conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall name him Jesus. He will be great, will be called the Son of the Most High, and the Lord will give him the throne of his father David. And 33 was the last verse.
Yeah.
And he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and his kingdom will have no end.
There we go. They've also called out Hebrews 12 and verse 2. We can read that if you want. You already got it looked up?
Yeah, I got it here. I'm going to start in verse 1. Therefore, since we have such a great cloud of witnesses, so we know that Chapter 11 was all the
that's the faith chapter.
Faith chapter.
Yeah.
Of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God.
That's obviously what this guy Pink had in mind when he wrote that sentence, right? Yeah. I mean, he's almost quoting it. Okay, that makes a lot more sense. All right, so number 7. Joseph foretold of his future sovereignty. And that's called out Genesis 37, verse 7 through 12. The exact same ones I just read.
Oh, so, really?
Joseph foretold of his future sovereignty. So again, I think that's referencing the sun, moon, and stars bowing down to him. It just says Jesus did the same. Okay. So the verse for that is Matthew 26 and verse 64.
I was in Mark. I couldn't find chapter 26.
Yeah, Mark doesn't go that far.
And this is Jesus speaking. And Jesus said to him, the high priest, I believe it is, "You have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven."
And I should note, I meant to do this before we even got started here, but you read from a different translation than New King James, what Richard and I primarily use. What are you using there?
I have the New American Standard.
Okay.
And it's not too dissimilar.
Yeah, it's fairly similar. I think it's a kind of an older translation, isn't it?
Well, it's newer than the Revised Standard, which is the pathetic one.
Okay. Well, that actual Bible that you hold in your hands looks like it's got a few years on it, too.
It's, it's almost 40 years old now.
There we go. All right, so I think we're on number 8. Joseph was envied by his brothers, and they call out 37:11. I think that one, we've really covered that one already. So the parallel is Jesus was envied by his brethren, not necessarily calling out his brothers by blood. Again, back to the tribe of Judah. And the reference for that is Matthew 27, verse 17 through 18.
And this is part of the trial of Jesus before Pilate.
Okay.
Where verse 17 says, "When therefore they were gathered together, Pilate said to them, 'Whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?'" I think in some places that's Jesus Barsabbas in some versions, but
what not. What do you mean?
Well, it's his, that's like a surname, Barsabbas. Word.
So the original guy that he does
his,
end up...
His name is also Jesus.
Okay.
But
just, I didn't know that.
Yeah, just, you know, it doesn't matter. But verse 18 then is the one. He says, "For he," that's Pilate, "knew that because of envy they had delivered him up."
His brothers, or the tribe of Judah, had delivered him because of envy, exactly the same as Joseph. And, I mean, his brothers gave him... We haven't got to that part in the story, but... He went to Egypt because his brothers envied him.
Yes, yes. And you know, verse 11 of Genesis 37 states that.
Yeah. All right, number 9. Joseph was sent by his father to his brothers and calls out 37:13. And Israel, or Jacob, said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." So he said to him, "Here I am." That's basically saying, "I'm ready to go." And then Jesus was sent by his father to the lost sheep of Israel, or his brothers, by heritage. And the verses referenced, he's got a bunch here. There could probably be a bunch more, but he's in the book of John. And first one is going to be chapter 4 and verse 34.
And Jesus said to them, his disciples, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work."
And then chapter 5 and verse 30.
And Jesus speaking, "I can do nothing on my own initiative. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just, because I do not seek my own will, but the will of him who sent me."
Yeah. And Let's do one more here. We got chapter 6 and verse 38 through 40.
Jesus speaking again, "For I have come down from heaven, not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me." Could just stop there. "And this is the will of him who sent me, that all that he has given me, I lose nothing, but raise it up on the last day. For this is the will of my Father, that everyone who beholds the Son and believes in him may have eternal life, and I myself will raise him up on the last day."
Who does the raising up?
Says Jesus is.
I think that's what the Bible says.
Mm-hmm. We won't read it now, but there's also a chapter 12, verse 48 and 50.
Through 50, yeah.
And
17 and verse 21.
17 and verse 21, which basically are saying,
yeah,
"My Father who sent me."
Yeah, that's a pretty easy one. I don't think we need to really pick that one down. Number 11, maybe we're on 10. I tried to skip ahead again.
Yeah, we're on 10.
We're on 10. So Joseph sought his brothers. That's when he goes to search his brothers, what we just read. Jacob sends him to Shechem, and he goes and seeks them out and has to ask a guy where they're at and eventually finds them. Jesus also sought his brethren, and it calls out Luke 19:10.
And that verse says, and this is again Jesus speaking, "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." But I also found a couple other verses, Matthew 14 and verse 10. I felt this was somewhat important. 14:10 says, well, I must have wrote down the wrong verse. Let me go to 15. Oh, no, Matthew. Let me go to 15:24. Yeah. Jesus says, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel."
Yeah.
And, of course, later it would be taken to the Gentiles and to the entire world. But
yeah, and just by the very fact that where was he born, what people was he around, what tribe was he born into, he sought his brothers or his brethren.
Yeah.
I think that's a concrete one.
It was first offered to, you know, the Jews.
Yeah, the disciples.
Yeah.
And those around them.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm glad I didn't read that verse that I wrote down. Find out what it was.
So let's go on to number 11. Joseph sought the welfare of his brothers. And again, same thing. They're still in reference to him going and looking for his brothers there in Shechem while they were tending sheep. And it says, "Jesus came not to condemn, but that the world might be saved through him." Calls out John 3:17 right next to the famous John 3:16. I think it's going to be almost a quote here.
For God did not send the Son into the world to judge the world, but rather that the world should be saved through him.
And I'm going to guess that other translations, probably the one this guy was using, probably uses condemn.
It very well might.
Yours is just a little different. Yeah. All right. So Joseph's father sent him to speak to his brothers and find them. Boy, we're still the same Genesis 37:14-17, where he's out looking for his brothers. He's really chewed that one apart, huh? Giving you a workout, Neil.
Yeah.
So the parallel with Jesus is Jesus's father sent him to speak and find us. I like that he did that. But he calls out Luke chapter 19 and verse 10.
And verse 10, "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." And that's Jesus speaking again.
And I like the way that the guy says that this is about us. It's not that he was sent to the house of Israel or the lost sheep or anything like that. He was sent to save what was lost in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
All of us.
All of us, yeah.
Throughout history. Okay, number 13. Joseph was conspired against. And this is going to be Genesis 37 and verse 18. Now, when they saw him afar off, they being his brothers, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. There's a parallel for sure. And for the parallel with Messiah, it says Jesus was also conspired against. And it calls out Matthew chapter 12 and verse 14.
And but the Pharisees went out and counseled together against him as to how they might destroy him. And there is another place, oh, it was after his resurrection, where it uses the word conspire, at least in the New American Standard,
yeah,
where it says that they conspired to with the guards to pay him money to, say they stole his body.
Yeah.
And if,
I would also argue that Judas conspired against him. He faced a lot of it.
We'll get to that too.
Okay. All right. So number 14, Joseph's brothers did not believe his dreams. And it calls Genesis 37 verses 19 and 29. So verse 19, then they said to one another, look, this dreamer is coming. As far as not believing in his dreams, I would think when they said, what, are we going to bow down to you? Might be a better reference to that. But anyway, he also calls out verse 29. Then Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes. I think that this gentleman may have had a couple of bad lookup references there. But anyway, Jesus' brethren did not believe his words. And it calls out Matthew, again back in Matthew 27, and verses 39 through 43.
Which says, and those passing by were hurling abuses at him, wagging their heads and saying, you who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. In the same way, the chief priests also, along with the scribes and elders, were mocking him, saying, he saved others, he cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him now come down from the cross, and we shall believe him. He trusts in God. Let him deliver him now, as if he takes pleasure in him. For he said, I am the Son of God.
Well, and back to Joseph here. Obviously, his brothers didn't believe in his dreams or what he was saying. But it did say that Joseph took it to heart, or Jacob took it to heart. Israel did.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
In the same way, Jesus wasn't believed by the tribe of Judah, the Jews, but his father believed in him.
True, yeah.
You know, there was, and his disciples, some of, they didn't fully comprehend it at the time, but they believed in him. I mean, he point blanked them and said, who do you say I am? And they said, the Messiah.
Yeah.
So they believed in him, but.
Well, their expectations of the Messiah were different than they turned out to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just look at what happened at the, at his death. They didn't scatter, but they went and hid.
Sure did.
You know, and then didn't really believe.
Yeah, that even he was the two alive. Guys afterward on the road to Emmaus, I think, you know, when they were saying, man, we had hoped he was going to be the Messiah.
Yeah.
But because he didn't do what they thought he was going to do, they had just thought, nah, he wasn't a Messiah.
Yeah.
He was a great guy, but he wasn't the Messiah. But he had to come and teach him. So anyway, we got another reference here. John 3, verse 18 and 36.
Verse 18, he who believes in him is not judged. He who does not believe has been judged already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. And the other one was?
36.
He who believes in the Son has eternal life, but he who does not obey the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abides on him.
Hmm.
So,
here's an interesting one. Again, this guy was going exhaustive style here, wasn't he? All right, so number 15. Joseph was stripped of his coat and calls out 37:23. This is when he lost his coat of many colors. So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. That was kind of a gift from his dad, and I think they even envied that coat. Because clothes were a lot more valuable back then. Today clothes don't mean near the same to us as they did to them back then. But anyway, so the reference or the parallel with Jesus is Jesus was stripped of his coat. And it calls out Matthew 27 in verse 27, 28. And then we'll go into the book of John again.
So this is at the time of the crucifixion. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole Roman cohort around him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. So they, you know, he had a robe on.
And then they mocked him in the robe and put him back in his clothes.
Right.
But then they eventually cast lots for his clothes as well.
And that's John 19.
Okay.
And what's that, verse 23?
Yeah.
Which says, the soldiers, therefore, when they had crucified Jesus, took his outer garments and made four parts, a part to each soldier, and also the tunic. Now the tunic was seamless, woven in one piece. And they said, this is verse 24, therefore to one another, let us not tear it, but cast lots for it, to decide who shall be.
Which was also prophesied by, I don't remember who, probably Isaiah, but one of the prophets prophesied that they would cast lots for his garments.
Or a psalm, maybe, but you're
was
right.
It?
Yeah,
okay.
There was somewhere, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not.
That's when we need Richard. Yeah, you can just memory recall all kinds of stuff that. Like that. It's amazing. All right, so number 16, Joseph was cast into a pit. And we know about that from the story, and it's on verse 24. And they took him and cast him into a pit. The pit was empty, and there was no water in it. I think it's actually like a cistern, wasn't it? Which is like a water, underground water reservoir.
Well, it's, you know, it talked about digging wells.
Seems like one of the translation calls that a cistern.
Well, the parallel to that was, Jesus was put in a tomb. Okay, a little different than a pit, but, and what is that, Matthew 27, verse 59, which says...
59 through 60.
And Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out in the rock, and he rolled a large stone against the entrance of the tomb and went away. That's another prophecy fulfilled.
Yeah.
That he would be in a tomb that had never been used.
So. Okay. Well, I think that for me, that's a little bit of a stretch to kind of call a parallel there. I mean, one's dead, the other one's not. One's a pit, the other one's a tomb. I see what the guys. I'm not putting this gentleman down, but it almost seems like with some of these that, you know, he had like 53 or something. He thought, man, 60 would sound a lot better. You know? And he went and looked for others. So anyway, number 17, Joseph was taken out of the pit alive in his body. That, of course, is when they pull him out to sell him to the traders. And verse 28, it calls, then Midianite traders passed by, so his brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. And, of course, the parallel is going to be the same thing, where Jesus was bodily resurrected from the tomb, it says. And it calls out, interestingly, 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 4, which is the resurrection chapter.
And starting verse 3, it says, for I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that He was raised on the third day, according to the scriptures.
Yeah, okay. You know, there's plenty of places you could go. Like when, I think it's in the book of John, when it talks about Mary going there on the first day of the week, basically as soon as she could, when the Sabbath was over, she hoofed it over there. All right, let's try and get through number 21, which finishes up with Genesis 37, because we're already at 56 minutes. All right, so number 18. Joseph's brothers mingled hypocrisy with their hatred. That's an interesting statement. And it calls out verse 27. Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brothers listened. So this is when Judah kind of steps up and makes the suggestion that they, well, let's not kill him, let's sell him.
Yeah.
Terrible. What did it say about that? It said mingled hypocrisy with their hatred. I'm not sure that's the verse he was looking for there, but let's go ahead. The Jews did the same with Jesus, and it calls out Matthew 27, back in Matthew 27, and verse 35 and 36.
And I believe we read this earlier, and when they had crucified him, they divided up his garments among themselves, casting lots. And setting down, they began to keep watch over him.
I think when they mocked him was a better, mingled hypocrisy with their hatred. All right, well, anyway, John, he also calls out John 18 and verse 28 and 31.
After this, Jesus, knowing that all things had already been accomplished in order that the scriptures might be fulfilled, said, I am thirsty. And a jar full of sour wine was standing there, so they put a sponge full of the sour wine upon a branch of hyssop and brought it to his mouth. When Jesus, therefore, had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished. And he bowed his head and gave up the spirit.
And then 31.
And the Jews, therefore, because it was the Sabbath, the day of preparation, so that the bodies should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath day, for that day was a high day, asked Pilate that the legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. And I'm not sure about that one either.
Yeah, that one's a bit of a stretch, but it, you know, our listeners can make up their own mind. We're just reporting. All right, so number 19, Joseph was sold for the price of a slave. Now, this one I find interesting and very relevant. And it calls out verse 38 in Genesis 37. There is no Genesis 37,
38. Go to 27.
28?
No, wait a minute. I wrote
that down because I found it. There it is. It should say Genesis 37, 28.
Yeah.
Then the Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph out of the pit, sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. We read that. But 20 shekels of silver would have been the price for a slave at that time. And then, of course, the famous ordeal with Judas. Jesus was sold for 30 pieces of silver, which was also prophesied. And that is Matthew 26 and verse 15.
Okay, I'll start at 14. Then one of the 12 named Judas Iscariot went to the chief priest and said, what are you willing to give me to deliver him up to you? And they weighed out to him 30 pieces of silver. Also in Matthew 14:10, it's the same, what do they call that?
All right, so verse or number 20 on our list here, going all the way to 60. Judas suggests the idea of selling his brother, and we read that 26 through 28 in Genesis 37. Now, this is really interesting. I read this one this morning and as I was looking this over. The Greek name for Judah is Judas.
And if you look up,
I did the word search
in the King James Version, it uses in Matthew 1,
Really? And the authorized King James had actually used it?
Yes. It said that, you know, in verse 2 says, to Abraham was born Isaac, and to Isaac Jacob, and to Jacob Judah and his brothers. And it's Judas.
Really?
In the King James, original King James.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's an interesting parallel there. So, last one we're going to do for today. Joseph's blood-sprinkled coat with goat's blood was presented to his father, and that's 37:31. So they took Joseph's tunic, they being his brothers, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, we have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not? And so the parallel, Jesus is our scapegoat, and his blood was presented to the Father as a sin offering. Dun, dun, dun. And goes to the famous Leviticus 16, where we can argue about goats endlessly and end friendships over something that's not even provable in the Bible.
Oh, wait a minute. I believe that this is Jesus in both cases.
Do not do that. Do not do that.
No, I thought it was a stretch when I read through this. But Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the Lord and one for the scapegoat. Then Aaron shall offer the goat on which the lot for the Lord fell and make it a sin offering. So there's the shedding of blood for the sin offering. But the goat on which the lot for the scapegoat fell shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement upon it. To send it into the wilderness as a scapegoat or a goat of departure, what some versions say.
I mean, I have no problem with this one. It's a little odd, but I think it's more in line than some of the others we've read here. But he's dancing on glass going to Leviticus 16.
Well, you know, you got to wonder about the guy that put this paper together, these correlations, but what was he thinking? Because I doubt he understood exactly what Leviticus 16 is all about. Maybe he did.
Maybe he did.
Maybe he had more knowledge.
Maybe back in the 1800s or whenever, they actually had a little better understanding before it was just complete. The Old Testament was completely wiped out of modern Christianity. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah. All right. Well, do you have anything else you want to add to our discussion for today?
No, I think we're good.
Okay. Can you come back next week?
I can work it in.
You can work me in? All right.
We might discuss the time.
Okay.
I don't know.
Can do that. We can change dates or whatever we need to do. Anyway, I appreciate you coming in. Appreciate your time. And we'll talk to you guys next time. Bye-bye.